Okay, this is the UVic Military Oral History Program interview with Mr. Barry Hall, recorded on the 6th of March 2015 in Saanichton, interviewed by Isabel Carey. So tell me about your life before joining the RCAF.
Well, before the RCAF, I was going to the school. I had been at 1 year in Victoria College and then 2 years at the Ontario Agricultural College. So because I had lived on the experimental farm, Dominion Experimental Farm out here in Saanichton all through my life up to that point, I was brought up in the agricultural field, so I was able to go down to the Ontario Agricultural College there and start off, and I put in 2 years there. during that time, though, I was in the summers, I was able to work on the farm and during my school years, and in the summertime, there was always picking fruit and that sort of thing, along with others. And then when after the war had started, the Patricia Bay Airport started to function, and there was building and all sorts of things going on down there, and so I found jobs there. And so that was basically what I was doing to broaden my outlook and my education in those days. That took me up to 1942 when I when I joined. I'd had 2 years down east in Guelph, and but the call of the call of the wild, the call of the war. It was. I don't know. You ask here, why did you join? There's always the element of patriotism. My father was a regular attender of the Veterans Association out here, War Vets.
Okay, yeah, so you mentioned your father.
Yeah, and he, and occasionally I'd go to some of the events that he was interested in there. Oh, I just remember now, maybe something else here. Prior to the war, make a long story short, I was a trumpeter. I'd taken up trumpet playing. And there was no brass band or any sort of a band here in Sydney. So when it came along to November the 11th, which was Armistice Day, and there was a ceremony out here. They needed a trumpeter, and the main source of music out here at that time was a bunch of pipers, Scottish pipers, and because they were always available, but that wouldn't have been suitable for the last post and reveille. So I was pressed into action, and I was able to play those at last post and reveille and the hymns for the ceremony, and I was only 16, 17, 18 in those years, 19. And then by that time, either I was away at Guelph in November, or and then the Air Force, the boys started coming in here, and they had their own band and so on. But in those pre-war years, I was sort of a one-man band out in Sydney, and I had a military feeling about me, but no, I wasn't old enough for anything like that.
Okay. So, yeah, you mentioned your father went to the military group. Do you want to explain what other members of your family?
Well, yes, he was an armorer sergeant over there. I asked him what he did, what he actually did, and he says, this was speaking to his young son, me, I fixed bicycles and guns. That sounds very simple to me, but yeah, I think it was a little bit more explicit. He could have been more explicit than that. But the thing was that he wasn't in the front lines with all the trench because my Uncle Reg, he was hospitalized with trench feet, and he had to leave the military after a while because he was not healthy. That was my uncle. My grandfather, he wanted to join up with his boys too, so he did, and this was back in Manitoba. And anyway, he joined up, and he was in the forestry corps, I think it was. And I have it written down here if you'd like to, you know, their particular places in the. Would you like that now?
Yeah, sure. If you just read
okay.
It
my there. Father, he was a staff sergeant, E.R. Hall. He was in the 160th Bruce Battalion Engineers. He was there from 1915 to 1918. My grandfather was Henry Selden Hall. He was in the 242nd Battalion of the CEF, which is the Canadian Expeditionary Force. And he was in there from September 1916 to November 1918 in the Canadian Forestry Corps. And then my uncle, my dad's brother, Reg Hall, he was in the 1st Canadian... Oh dear. First Canadian United Rifles. I'll have to clarify that for you, but he was in the 1st Canadian Rifles from February 1916 to June 1919, and he was over in Petit Vimy in West Flanders.
Okay.
Up to the time Vimy Ridge exploits happened, and then he was I think it was about that time that he had this trench foot problem. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay.
She can get that. Reg Hall. He was in the 1st Canadian Mounted Rifles, and stationed over there in Petit Vimy in West Flanders.
Okay. So why did you join the Air Force instead of the other branches of the military service?
Well, I thought you should ask that question because I wanted to join the Navy that summer, and I went in July and into the recruiting offices in Victoria there, and I went to the Navy recruiting place, and all they had to offer was a stoker position of a stoker, and it came to my mind that I didn't want to be shoveling coal for the next number of years if that's what a stoker was. I don't think a stoker really does that, but I mean only, but that's a term, a general term. So I crossed the street over to the Belmont building where the recruiting office was for the Air Force, and I just made my mind up within a few minutes there to join the Air Force. So, and I wanted to be a pilot. Well, I put in to be a pilot, and that's where my training started, and we'll talk about that in a few minutes.
Go ahead. Where were the offices? Where did you sign up?
That was in Victoria.
Okay.
Yeah, Victoria, right down by the Inner Harbor there. One side was the Customs Building, which is still there, and that's where the Navy people were recruiting. And across the road was the Belmont Building, and it's still there, and that's where the RCAF were. Yeah, and so I signed up, because I was working here, this was in July, I indicated that I really didn't want to go away until sometime in September, and so that was fine with them. And so I signed up them and I noticed by my records that I got a leave of absence for about 3 months till I left in September. But I left in September of 1942 for Edmonton, Manning Depot in Edmonton. And that's where I started my military career. Edmonton, Alberta, Manning Depot. And on to the next question, okay. I guess it was.
Yeah. So did you or your family have any concerns about you joining?
Not really, because my father was familiar with the call of the country and the need. And really, at that time, there was Britain was really going through, or had gone through, and was still in a real barrage of bombings and fighters, you know, a fighter aircraft coming over, and the casualty lists were named off, you know, it was named in the news every day, so we were all, even though we were a long ways away from it there, we were all very cognizant of what was going on, and it wasn't hard to take time out of my life just to do something that was worthwhile.
And yeah. Do you think your family's military past helped with you?
Oh, yes, I do. Yeah.
Okay, so next question. Where did you initially train? Can you tell me about when and where?
Where did you initially train? Well, I initially, with the training started there in Edmonton at Manning Depot, and we learned the rule of discipline in a very strict way. And there was an ex-RCMP, I don't know, he's, for lack of a better term, a drill master. There he was about 6'6" and built accordingly, and he was a disciplinarian, and it was good because we were all toe the mark with him, and that was a good start. And then that's where we learned our drills and military behavior more than Air Force, because the Army and the Air Force anyway, you formed up in the same sort of ranks. It was much the same discipline as one as the other, and so that was the beginnings of, and we learned to salute properly and all these things that were musts, and also at the same time, there were other, it was the time of the Commonwealth Air Training Program, and there was other nations such as New Zealand, Australians, and from Britain too. People were all coming into this Commonwealth Air Training Program, which was being carried out in Canada, and it was they just had thousands and thousands of these young men coming in for training, and because it was sort of a safe place for that, and it was good. It was, so my point here was that Australians would come in and we would get acquainted with them and their language. They have a little different accent too. But so that's about, that's where we got started, and of course we picked up more training as we went along, in the military, but we also went to school too, and but not at Manning Depot. We didn't do any schooling there, really.
Okay. So how long was that first training for?
The first training? As far as training was concerned, we had to, after going to Manning Depot, we had to wait for courses in to open up for us, because they were either full or not full, and they had to be organized. So by the time we so while we're waiting around, we would be posted somewhere else, and we were from Manning Depot there in Edmonton. After they moved us on to Saskatoon. This is in the middle of winter, and Saskatoon, it can't be any colder than Saskatoon in the middle of winter. And guard duty there at night. Oh well, we won't. You know, 50 below, 52 below one night, and this is Fahrenheit, obviously. And we had a stay there of a couple of months, waiting for an opening in the number 2 ITS initial training school in Regina, where all categories of air crew got a basic education in what was involved, including meteorology and gunnery and recognized aircraft recognition, just to name a couple of them. But all that was at there. Then we, because I was wanted to be a pilot, I was posted on to number 2 EFTS, Elementary Flying Training School, in Fort William, Ontario. And it was there that I got 32 hours on Tiger Moss, and I'm glad to have that under my belt anyway, but then the terminology is it got washed out. That is, you got switched to another part of air crew. And there were so many of us that got washed out that I estimated it was about 40% of the course numbers at that time. And I felt really bad about it, but when I found out how many of my friends that were joining me, I didn't feel quite so bad. But so there, I went from there to a navigation school at Portage la Prairie. And I was 5 months there. So if you're counting all these months up, 5 months there, and then you were sent home on leave you got a month leave at home. And then you had embarkation. That was embarkation leave. On our way down to Halifax, which was our embarkation point to jump on the board ship, they took us off at Lachine and said, surprise, they're changing the embarkation depots and we're sending you another month's leave. And I just left 1 month's leave. I didn't want to go back home, so I spent a month in Ontario in the middle of winter enjoying skiing, and my friend Jim Eddy, who was from Geraldton, Ontario, he and I spent a whole week up in the Laurentians, just hopping from one little village to another. That was another experience that I won't forget, that one. But this is the way all the time is taken. Then they brought us back to Lachine, Quebec. Lachine, Quebec, part of Montreal, where we had to, that was the embarkation, and wait for a ship. And then we would go down, but the ships weren't available. And we were sent out again to Quebec City on a 2-week commando course. And this, you can include all this in our training, but I guess in the commando course, if you got shot down and had to escape, this would be good knowledge to follow. So That's what they had us doing. We had to crawling through tunnels, you know, and barbed wire and all sorts of stuff. And then, route marches every day and trying to get us into shape. Eventually, the call came, come back. Your time has come to come back to Lachine, and then we'll send you back down to Halifax. So there's a lot of shifting around there, but that, and it was March of 1944, where I had reported in September of 42, but it was March of 44 before I got on the ship. So all that was in training, so to speak. Yeah.
Okay.
In training. Maybe I could talk more about the type of aircraft that we were working, that we were flying in that 5 months there in Portage-la Prairie. But is that?
What training were you given as part of as being for being a navigator?
Well, as a navigator, yeah, we were flying in Avro Anson's, and it was. That, of course, was operated by a pilot, and remember whether he had anybody to help, and an engineer. I think it was two of them in the aircraft, plus a student navigator. And we would be assigned to do this, that, and the other thing, and to show them the courses and do our training there in these aircraft. And we did a little photography work there, too. They had a little glass perspex bubble on the side there that you could put your camera in and do some little camera work that was part of the course. I still have some of those pictures around of my taking pictures of a road crossroads intersection with wheat fields on each side and stooks in the fields and all that. Yeah. That was an interesting thing, but we were basically in Anson's in those days, and some of them were still around. They were widely used in training, and again out here at Patricia Bay, they were being used in training and all over North America, really. So that was just a thought there that things that we were doing there during training.
Okay, so what were your experiences with British officers and air crews during training? I know you've mentioned the...
Which number is that?
It's number 7. Oh, you've mentioned the Dominions before, like New Zealand.
And... Oh, the British officers?
Yeah.
Well, we... all our officers were Canadian. I don't really know how this question would fit in, or the answer would fit into this question. There was the whole training plan pretty well was operated under Canadian officers, and I'm taking this question literally here. Air crews, but there was a number of British young men from England that were over there in our course group, and they were in training. Oh, they fitted right in. We had great social times and I have a number of pictures in our group pictures with these brethren all there, and we got to know them a lot. But as far as the we didn't really have official experiences with anybody from the RAF or anything like that. How were the crews within your squadron picked? Now, we were, yeah. This is a story in itself, but there was a lot went on between our training and how they and getting to this squadron crew thing. because we were when we got to Britain, we were stationed, held a holding unit in Bath. Bournemouth, and the hotel's name was Bath, and we were there for about a month till we got assigned to our courses and so on in various other parts. We went up to Cheltenham after that, and I saw my first jet there while we were stationed at Cheltenham. We were out just on a walking around on spare time, and we were near the airport at Staverton, and we looked over the fence. We could hear this particular roar. And we saw the flames coming out of the rear end of this aircraft, and decided it was a jet, the first we'd ever seen. And we stopped and looked in awe at this. It was just taxing around the perimeter of this, getting ready for takeoff, I guess. But it was at Staverton I saw my first jet. It was sort of a highlight of my life of that in those days, anyway. Now, by the time we got to crewing up, there was some more training work in another aircraft, the Wellington, and the Wellington was a two-engined bomber that they used in the earlier parts of the war. It was rather it was a good bomber in its day, but it had a reputation of, if it ever caught fire, because its sides were all fabric, if a fire was in there, it was just completely demolish it, and it didn't have a good reputation that way. But we never got into any problems like that. It was used in training when we got there, and I don't think it was doing bombings over on the continent at that time, but it was a good aircraft, and I had now we're up to when we should get crewed up, because here we're still just uncrewed, so. We went from there to a conversion unit. That is where you're converted to a four-engined bomber, which was going to be the real thing. And that was up at Topcliffe in Yorkshire. And while up there, as soon as you arrived up there, my memory is going into quite a large room. And all these other air crew there, and then the announcement comes that you're to choose your own crew members, words to that effect. And the pilots all were in a separate room, but all the other six categories. The pilots were seven. We were all in one room there. And so, who are you going to find? Here I am, a navigator. Who am I going to find? And lo and behold, one of the fellows that got washed out at the same time as I did in elementary flying training school, wanted to be a pilot, he was there in that room. And he'd been assigned to be a bomb aimer. So he and I wrapped our arms around each other in recognition and said, where are we going to go from here? Who else do you know here? And we didn't really know anybody, but through one way or another, We picked up two gunners, Graham Armstrong. He was from Windsor, Ontario, and Pete Petaskey, he was from Edmonton, and Frank Dupuy, our radio man. That and where are we? Our engineer. All our engineers in these Canadian aircraft crews were British, and this was Bill Chubb was his name, and he was from London, I think, with his accent and everything else. And Bill is still alive, one of the few that's still over there, and I correspond with his son, and because Bill is not a computer expert. But anyway, Bill, and there, here we are, all in the same room, and we'd crewed up, and then they brought in the pilots, and we connected up with a pilot that had been on as a training pilot back in Ontario, I think, in Hagersville, I think, in the little airport there, and he was training other pilots. And he'd worked himself up to be a flight lieutenant, so he was looking for a crew, and we attached ourselves onto him, and his name was Bill Miller, W.E. Miller, and excellent pilot, and a little bit older than the rest of us, because we were just in our early 20s, but he was late 20s, really old. And so there we had a crew of seven, and that's what we went on with. But that was at Topcliffe. Then we were posted to Eastmoor, and that's number seven comes to my mind. But that was our how we got crewed up. It was very casual. But it worked, and so we were very, very fortunate in having everybody working together and happy with each other's behavior. Yeah. Okay. Bob Amer was from Odessa, Saskatchewan. He went on to be a school teacher in Davidson, Saskatchewan. Frank Dupuy, we'd never get in touch with him after, well, it was, somebody did, but he didn't want any communication with anybody in the crew. Some people are like that, you know, after the war, they just clam up and go on. So Frank, but he came from back in Ontario, and then Pete Petaskey, he was he worked in a egg sorting plant in Edmonton before the war, grading of eggs. He was an egg grader, and we always kidded him about that. He died though early after the war. But we were all Canadians. Yeah, Army. He went with the Ford Motor Company in. He lived in Essex, Ontario, but he went with the Ford Motor Company just across the border in the U.S., and he spent all his working years there, about 40 years there.
Okay. That's about it. So, yeah, next question. So talk me through the preparation undertaken by navigators for each mission. That's number nine.
Well, incidentally, missions. I was told in no uncertain terms that we don't do missions.
Okay.
We do operations.
Okay. Sorry.
Yeah, and missions is an American term.
Okay.
That they use down in U.S. Mm-hmm. But up in Canada and in our empire, mm-hmm. It's operations, and that's why we have an ops wing, an operations wing when we do so many operations, not missions. Okay. It's a minor detail.
No, sorry. Yeah, thank you.
So we're the preparations for an op would be, well, the call would go out to report to the briefing room at such and such a time, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, GMT, and we would all be there, all properly clothed and pencils in hand, sitting at a table and waiting for the directions. They come in, the briefing officers would come in, and followed by the Met, the meteorology people with bring you information of the weather and all that, and of course they would tell you where you would be going and what the route would be, and it would all be huge map on the board, and they would ahead of time they would have the little pinpoints on your for your turning points with the strings, you know, this is how you get there and this is how you get home. And that was for the benefit of the navigators. That's all in preparation for this, for the trip. We would, the first, of course, we would be told what the target would be for that night or day. So we would be, I think you wanted to know, well, we'll talk about how we identified the points later on. So so with all that, we would, at that time, we would be told how the targets would be marked. The color of the flares, they're always marked by flares. So we would be told whether it was red and green or yellow and black or whatever. And it was the, so you say, well, how do the flares get there? Well, that was the job of the Pathfinder Force, PFF. And they were chosen few to take in bombers, like the Mosquito Bomber, which is a two-engined. I think there's only about three in that crew. Or the Lancasters at the end, anyway. The Lynx would go in there, but they're all chosen crews, and only a half a dozen or so, my understanding, of them would be involved in any single target. And they would because they were expert in their work, in their performance, they would be chosen to go in and mark the target. And sometimes the target would be, I think, about two times out of three, the target wouldn't be clear, it would be clouded over. As a navigator, it was our duty to report back at debriefing as to what the weather was like. And we would say it was 10/10 or 6/10, or that is, the cover of the cloud would be that. So in our, as far as our visibility was concerned. But the so these aircraft would go in there at lower level, and they're really taking their life in their hands when they're doing that. And we had a a young fellow from Victoria by the name of Reggie Lane, who I remember from before the war. He worked in the Hudson's Bay Company. In the main store there on what used to be the main store on Douglas Street, and he was a tobacconist. He wasn't even 20, but he was working in this tobacco store at right where the elevators came down. I remember it, that he worked there in the tobacconist shop, and the elevators were right here, and I recognized him from later on, that, hey, that's the guy that, you know, That was that worked in the Hudson's Bay. He went on as a PFF man. I don't know whether he switched to mosquitoes or not, but he was in there marking these targets, and he survived. And by the time he left over there, he was a group captain. He was getting up there. But I think in later years, I think he got a rank or two higher than that. And I don't want to predict what he... I don't know whether he's still alive now or not. I have a feeling that he's passed on. This is 2015, so... Reggie Lane from Victoria, but he was my hero. If you're looking for heroes and some, he was a hero in my life. That's how the targets were marked over there. These guys went in, and if anybody deserves a medal, they should. And of course, there's a lot of casualties there too. And as far as marking, I think later on here you're asking about seeing the...
Oh yeah, that brings me to the next question. How easy or difficult was it to find the targets?
Well, it wasn't always easy because we did a number of, two-thirds of our trip, I guess, the trips were at night. But at night we could... we could see glows. The clouds beneath us would reflect the glow of fires and bomb bursts and so on, and that would help you in a way to identify the target, wherever the concentration of glows was. We had. You also asked here. You were wondering about our navigation aids. Mm-hmm. We had a.
So that's question 12. How did the available technology help or hinder your operations?
Here we had you call it a radar, unit in our aircraft, which was fastened underneath the aircraft. It was a bubble under there, and there was a scanner in there sending out a signal, and the signal would go to the ground, and by its shape and it could be read back on a screen in your aircraft as to whether you're over a river, whether you're over a whole bunch of rooftops. That would reflect differently than a forest, something like that. And you've got to be able to read what these images were that came back on your screen, and that way you could get pinpoints for navigation. You knew where you were if you could identify it that from reading your map. So you'd find that on your map and you knew where you were. That was simplifying it, or you were so many miles away from it. But this scanner was working there, and it would give you it worked pretty good. It would go down through clouds, of course, and other smoke and whatever. The other radar that we had was radio beams, and they were the continent was we had no radio towers in the continent. They were both these beams were from England, but they were from widely separated as they could get them, and yet still be effective over in the. So wherever the beams crossed, that's where you were. And so that gave you a fix as to where you were. But the further away you got from Britain, the greater the, or the less, whichever way you want to look at it, the greater the angle or the less. If you got crosshairs, you know you were there. But if it starts, you know, at a greater angle, there was a lot of space there as to accuracy, as to where you were, because you could you would be just a degree out here, and yet you're 100 miles out over there. So, but it, but this G-box, as we called it, was very effective, though, and especially in good weather, and that was another way that we identified where we were. I have a record, just tell you right now, I have a debriefing record of all the trips that I was on, and I'm very fortunate to get that because I don't think there's many people around that have that. And we got this through a friend of a crew friend of ours. He lives back in Norfolk, but each one of our trips is identified by what we reported back. And I'll let you have a look at that a little later on if you like.
Were you sufficiently warned about the level of difficulty involved in navigating?
Only at the briefings time, at the time of briefing, that we would be warned that there was fighters out and be aware of them, and that the city is heavily defended by anti-aircraft guns and things like that. But that's about all, but rather a general statement. We were never attacked. Our particular crew and craft, we weren't attacked at any time by any fighter. I know our Pete, he was in our tail gunner, and he reported letting off 600 rounds there because he thought he saw something. Well, it's better to be safe than sorry, I guess. But we never we didn't run into any problems there. We did get some damage from anti-aircraft flak exploding around us, and I have it was reported in one of our debriefings. Cayman, I think, was the name of the city or the town that we were after, we were going to, where the piece of flak came up. Yeah, the flak came up through the escape hatch. I didn't know about that until years later. The navigator sat right over top of the escape hatch in the Halifax. So, ooh, that would have been sore. I didn't know, but it must have been a spent piece or something. It just came in and flopped down. But it's in the record, and yeah.
Okay. Well, were you given any information about the success of other operations?
We didn't know when we were being debriefed. Right after debriefing, we just as a thought here, we went in for our supper. We always had an egg, fried egg, which was really good because other guys didn't get those. Yeah, and so we didn't get much debriefing. We would say, we would hear though by the grapevine that that wasn't a very good raid, or oh, that was an excellent one or something. But it wasn't an official, we weren't told officially, no.
Okay. What would happen if you were unable to find your target? Was there any...
We always found the target, but if there was something came about that we couldn't drop the bombs, they were dropped over the in the English Channel or in on the in some place that wouldn't interfere with, you know, we just didn't, wouldn't drop them on a, another part of the city or something or other, or in the countryside even. We waited till we got over the water. And sometimes there was, there would be what you call a hang up in the, with a bomb. And it was somebody in the aircraft anyway, had the responsibility of, after bombs were dropped, just to inspect, to see that everything had cleared out. And it happened, though, that one time we landed, walked away from the aircraft, and we got a report back that when the ground crew opened the bomb doors, a bomb dropped out. But because those bombs don't go off without, you know, they got that tail fin on them, or propeller on the back. So when they're going down, that propeller is regulated so that they'll go off if even above ground. But they'll go off, you know. I'm not an armorer, but that has a bearing on whether they go off or not. So this one just dropped from here to here, 6 feet down. Gives you an awful feeling, though. I don't know really why that happened, but I guess there was a mistake made somewhere, but we all walked away and didn't hear about it till later. Nobody was hurt.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, yeah. But that, but you're asking about what do you do with these? You just find a, as far as I can remember, and just over the ocean, and you report where you did it, and so on.
And did you have any engine problems, or how would you have dealt with engine?
Well,
problems?
We had one engine problem was we went over to Kiel to bomb some submarine pen over there at Kiel. Kiel is a canal that, well, you don't know, at the southern part of Denmark, between Denmark and Germany. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The Kiel Canal, anyway. And that's, we were on our way over there. I think we got practically all the way over, but we lost a outer starboard engine. Had to turn around, come back, had to drop our bombs in the sea. And, but anyway, yeah. And Bill, he brought in the aircraft and the rest of us safely on three engines. So that's what you do when you lose an engine.
You've already talked about how what the relationship was like between crew members.
Yeah.
So we'll skip over that one. How do the machines used in the training mission, or training operation, sorry, compare to those that you flew in later, and what aircraft did you fly? So that's question 17.
In the training missions, I think at this stage in my life, all I can remember is the two-engined Wellington bomber that we did some training in. But I don't think we spent much time, because we weren't a crew by that time. There's no way a crew of seven could get into a Wellington bomber, so. We didn't, there was really no comparison between our training, and we went up to Topcliff and got into these four-engine bombers, and they were all Halifaxes, and we stayed on Halifaxes. So that's about it. I didn't. There wasn't any more aircraft involved there. A lot of it is ground school, where you get instructed on things, but you don't get the practical. Yeah.
Okay. And we've already kind of gone over question 18 as well, but I'll read it out, and then if you think of anything extra...
I can give you something there.
Okay. Did your crew suffer any casualties, or was your aircraft ever damaged by AA, and were you ever attacked by a German night fighter?
Well, we talked about the AA and the aircraft, mm-hmm. or handy, by those guns. Outside of that, we had there was a piece of flak came through from above and hit the pilot is protected by a piece of perspex behind his neck, and then behind that is the instrument panel for the not the engineer, no, it would be the signals man, the wireless op, he was back in there, but anyway, there's this to protect the back of his head. And anyway, this piece came in, hit this piece of perspex, and this chunk just dropped to the floor. It was spent, as far as energy was concerned. And I'd like to know where that piece is right now and whose hands that is. There's somebody in our crew, I think, somewhere is. But that and a few holes in the fabric and in the aircraft fuselage and so on. Nothing serious. But this other, one of our crew members did suffer. This was, we weren't airborne, but we were going from the briefing room out to the aircraft, and they're out there in the disposal units, dispersal units. Areas where they just sit and all the work is done on them and so on, and they're not all in one great area where they could be attacked and destroyed. So we were out there, we were going from the briefing room out there, and you're usually packing you're always packing your parachute and other gear and your bags, so you go in an open truck. Well, it's got the protection over the top, but the back you just jump off. Well, our mid-upper gunner, Graham, he's just known as Army, Graham Armstrong, he was swinging off the truck with his gear in this hand and supporting with this hand, and his ring caught on a bolt, the threads on a bolt on the post, and it just... He stripped his finger. Yeah. And there his finger was on the ground, and there was no blood. It was just white, you know.
Ooh.
Oh, ouch. Yeah. And so that put, that he got injured. He didn't go on that trip. But it took quite a while. You know, all by this, we were still going to go ahead and do our trip. And they had scrambling around to get somebody else to fill his place, because we wouldn't have gone without an upper gunner. And so we were taxiing out and getting into, you get lined up about three and one behind the other, ready to take off, and at 2 minute intervals, and or closer than that, I guess it was. And we got down there just ready to go, and the Jeep comes up, and the spare gunner jumps out, and he gets inside, and away we go. Oh, yeah. Well, Bill, our pilot, he got extra praise for that. He got the DFC for two or three things he'd done, and he got the Distinguished Flying Cross, DFC, for all these things. But that was the only injury. Well, meanwhile, Army back at the hospital, they tried to put his finger back together, and it was like for about a week, I think, or so, and it stayed on. But he lost, so he still waves his hand. He did. He's passed away now. Yeah.
Okay. So, how many of the operations were during the day or night, and how did these experiences compare?
Oh, there was 18 at night, and 8 during the day. The daylight ones were grouped more or less at the end, well, at the end, as the war was drawing to a close over there. And there was a few night raids sprinkled in between, but the night operations were conducted in total darkness, that is, no running lights, no lights in the aircraft except on the navigator's desk, and there was a window across on the fuselage side there, but it had a curtain over it, so no light could get out there anyway. And there was a curtain over the between the navigator and the bomb aimer's compartment out in front, where there was no light as well. So, except when he was when we were on a bombing run, I guess he was he had a very small light there on his equipment, but that would be it. So, it was quite an exciting time to be operating with hundreds of other aircraft around you at various times and at various altitudes, but as long as everybody was there in their place on time, theoretically everything would go fine. So it was very important to keep yourself on time at that altitude, otherwise you'd either be overrun or run over somebody else, or some things can happen. Another thing, as far as the navigation was concerned, if you were, for instance, 2 minutes ahead of time, you wanted to waste 2 minutes, slow down, you can't put the brakes on, just go slower, really. You continue on at the same speed, but you do a jog off to the right of 45 degrees, and then back again to the left of 90 degrees, and then another 45, and you should be back on track. If you do it 2 minutes out, 2 minutes back, you should be sort of on a equilateral triangle. That can be exciting too, because you're going along in a stream of 100 aircraft, for instance, and in the dark of night you do an extreme right turn. You hope you're in most of those nights, though it isn't a complete darkness. There is some degree of vision, but often you be do a jog over to the right and then back to the left, and you cross over a slipstream of somebody that's just ahead of you. So it always gives you a interesting little jolt, you know. Oh, well, we missed that guy, sort of thing, you know, or he missed us. But you knew by the slipstream if you were close to somebody else. In the daylight, that wasn't possible, and that didn't happen. But in the daylight, I was able to sometimes get up in front, right up in the nose, and see what the bombing target was, and some of the scene at that time, you know. And sometimes it's pretty horrific, but I saw very little of that as a navigator. My bomb aimer said I was always too scared to go up and do it. Probably was great. On one occasion, though, I did see an accident in the daylight. And this was when it was a hundreds of aircraft over this target. And we were all assigned, you're assigned a certain height at a certain time. And in the daytime, you see where the other aircraft are around you. And you look above, so you're not, and you're getting close to the target, and you know those bombs are going to come down, and you don't want to be under somebody else, obviously. Mm-hmm. And you don't want to be too close to them. So people, the pilots are doing just minor little jogs around and so on. We were very fortunate and didn't get into any problem like that, but the word went out quickly in our from our crew members that there was an aircraft down below us there that was in trouble, and so I had to get up and see what this trouble was. And it had been hit by bombs from somebody above, and it cut through the fuselage, and the fuselage was in two pieces, and the tail piece, you know, because of the tail planes and rudders and stuff, it was just going down like a leaf, like this. And the other piece was going off with all its engines still roaring, you know, going off without a tail. And saw three chutes in the air out of seven, yeah. But that's the only accident I ever saw and I don't know whether that was before or after the bombing, but that was attention getting, and it reminded you of what could happen and things to avoid. That was about it.
So it's partially linked to question 21, so I'll come back to question 20 in a minute. But are there any other operations that particularly stand out in your mind, and what was your most difficult operation?
No, there's no other. I think I've covered all the ops. But the most difficult one, or the longest one, was over to Leipzig, which was way over in eastern Germany. That was a 9-hour round trip. The one thing about it is that the further you go, the less weight of bombs you can carry, because you have to carry gas to get back fuel. So we made two trips over there. Another one was to Böhlen, which had oil refineries there. It wasn't far from Leipzig. I never know whether to call it Leip or Leip, but it's a long ways away, 9 hours. Just droning along, it can become quite boring. It was toward the end of the war. I was fortunate in being able to put my time in over there at that time, because the aircraft, the fighters over there were not a prominent feature in those days. The last 6 months of the war, from the turn of the year, and yeah, I guess that was, but the anti-aircraft were always there, and they were radar operated. Speaking of that, something that you never wanted to get into at night was to get in the searchlights. One searchlight, it's fairly easy to avoid. It's easier to avoid one searchlight than two or three, but if you get coned, there's one from here and one there, and they'll cone you, and it just brightens things up just like day, and it's very difficult to get out of there. I think they were radar operated too. Once you got coned, it was pretty well game over.
Yeah, so did that ever happen to you or anyone you know?
No, we we had certain procedures to follow if you did get any searchlight on you. Mm-hmm. You know, we never saw any more than one in our area anyway. We were very fortunate in our missions. I shouldn't say missions, I said in our but our whole mission was a very, very lucky and easy one. And it was towards the end of war, and that was, things were easier then. The fellows during the middle of the war and the beginning, they had much more difficult time. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, so going back to question 20, at the time were you concerned about the effectiveness of the bombing? I mean, as you just mentioned, it was towards the end of the war.
Well, yeah. There was always concern as to, you know, because you weren't bombing, you weren't going over to bomb cathedrals and houses and stuff. You were aiming for yards, and it was, I mean, railway yards and that sort of thing. And if there was collateral damage, well, that was sad and too bad. But targets were, anyway, as far as I understood, the targets were just military ones, railway yards, fuel stations, depots, submarine pens, and all that. That was basically it. So,
okay. So what was life like in the UK between operations? Did you have much contact with British civilians, and what did you do for recreation?
Oh, yeah. Sometimes too much. We had, as far as recreation was concerned, for every 7 weeks of on duty, so to speak, we had 1 week off. We would, that was another thing that practically all of our crew, except Bill the engineer, he went home, but the rest of us didn't have homes over there. So we, our pilot, Bill Miller, he had relations up in Scotland, outside of Edinburgh, a place called Bonnyrigg. And so we started going up there with Bill, and we would get a hotel room down in Edinburgh and we'd stay there for the week. And, oh yes, there's always lots of things to do and pubs to get into. And for everyday activities back down in at Eastmoor, which was 7 miles out of York. York was the social place, and there was a place there called Betty's Bar, which was a favorite with the Canadian Air Force. Mm-hmm. And to this day, apparently there's a great big wall there. It's either a mirror or a wall that has inscripted names. People, airmen have written their names on this wall, and there's a sacred place. But and there was dance halls there and all sorts of fun stuff that we were able to get de-stressed. A fair amount of stress, well, it depends. Some people were more stressed out than others. You know, some of the airmen were. But we never knew, before we went into town, we never knew if we were going on a raid the next day or not. I say a raid, you know. Yeah, if we're going on a trip the next. But if we were stood down, we were told there's nothing on tonight, well, then we can go into town. Otherwise, it was keep your mouth shut, Yeah. Now I didn't tell you yet that well, this is the social side of our time over there. I went on a blind date with my pilot, Bill Miller, one time. He had a cousin that was in a WD Women's Division of the RCAF over there, and she was stationed at 6 Group Headquarters, which is our headquarters. She was stationed over there. And so he made contact with her when he was over there, and he used to go out on dates with her. And her name was, I didn't find out till later, Winifred, but she was known as Dusty. All Millers are called Dusty because it comes from the old days when Millers were grinders of wheat and grain, and they all got all dusty. Okay. Dusty and Bill, and they, so I went on a blind date, and they brought along this beautiful young lady who was also another WD. Anyway, long story short, she was from Kitchener, Ontario, and we got quite friendly over there, and this, by when she came home, she came out here to visit me. Yeah, we got engaged. I went back there. We were married in September of 1946, back in Kitchener, Ontario. And then we came back here and set up housekeeping and had our children all out here. She left her home back there. She had been, though, in working in headquarters over there, along with Dusty and other young girls. You know, they're only... Well, she wasn't even 20 when she went over there. But she has been trained as a stenographer, and a teletype operator was sort of the forerunner of fax machines, that type of thing, where you could type in your message, and then at the other end it would come up all printed up. And this was within the... within the Air Force realm, whatever. And so she and I had our family out here. But while, so along comes this recognition of those, this is about a year, 2 years ago now, recognition with this bar for the Volunteer Medal. No, your Overseas Star Medal. You got a medal for being overseas. You got this extra bar for being World War II a bomber command. I got one for myself, and I pleaded one for my wife because of her position over there, and because they were involved in all these signals that went back and forth of... She would know of all the targets and stuff before I never got to me as a crew member. So she got a bar too.
Oh, yeah. Nice.
And I got that. I'll show you that.
Okay.
I'll tell you after something about I want to get a written history of the WDs who worked at 6 Group Headquarters there in helping the Canadian airmen through this time of their life over there. But I think there should be something written up about them, and I spoke to Lloyd about that yesterday, okay. I guess it was. And so, yeah, he thought that would be a good idea, and he doesn't know of anything so far that's been done. So...
kind of going back to the recreation, did you find that you maybe like not hung around with as a bit, but you, I guess, just stayed with the Canadians or were...
Oh, well, yeah, we pretty well stuck to our own our own group. We got to know, you know, all the other crews and so on. That's another point, though, that it was been pointed out anyway since or before, that it was not recommended that you get too friendly with other crews, because you never know. They've gone today, here today and gone tomorrow. Mm-hmm. I had a good friend of mine, Pat Breyer, who came from over here in the Fraser Valley. We trained together, you know, like through all the ground school work and so on. And he decided, before he went overseas, he decided to get married. He married another gal that was WD. I was the best man at his wedding. Mm-hmm. And he was married. This ceremony was done in Laurier Hotel in Ottawa. And then when he got posted to another squadron than I did after all this training, but he ended up in the same Nissen hut. Yeah, because our squadrons were on the same base. 415 and 432 were on the same base. And yeah, and so that was great. But we went out on a raid that night. That both squadrons were out. And the bed was empty in the morning, just like that, you know. That's, I'm just saying that you never know when you're going to lose your best friend.
Yeah.
You know, you don't, and that could really throw you off. But Pat, yeah, too bad. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you just, you know, and the bed sheets are still... Yeah, where's Pat? He could have been POW, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you never know.
But you never know. But we soon found out that they were, they were gone. So that was 415 Squadron, Duisburg, I think it was, that we went on. Yeah.
Okay. So last question, but then if there's anything else you remember anything afterwards, then we can continue. But on your return, how did you find the transition back to normality?
It wasn't easy. I thought, oh heck, I'm home now, did I? But in one particular, I found, I guess you would put it down as being restless. Sort of like quitting smoking. Do you ever smoke? No?
Not me, no.
No. Okay. If you ever had to stop smoking, one of the things, what do you do with your hands? You know, you're always, you know, your hands are in your pockets, or you always got to have a cigarette right after a meal, that sort of thing, and these, it's sort of it is habit, very much habit, and addictive habit for me. And it appeared to me that it took a week or two to get over that feeling. I know I borrowed the dad's car there one night, being home for a couple of days, and I went just. I didn't know what to do with it. As I drove into Victoria and drove back out again, you know. Just nobody did. Well, you didn't. Your friends had all gone, or you know, or doing something else.
Yeah.
So you had to start from scratch again. Sort of a. But I had lots of because I'd come from this area. I had lots of people to go back to and rely on, and it didn't take long to. Get going again.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've actually missed a question out. So just going back to question 23, is there anything you wish you'd been told prior to signing up?
No. That I wish you had been told before. No, I didn't have any surprises.
Okay.
No. I was told to do some things that I didn't follow up on. But I was warned of things, you know, sort of things that would happen in the Air Force. Oh, stay away from drinking, stay away from smoking, because I was a pretty clean living guy in those days. But outside of that, no.
Okay. Is there anything else that...
I can't think of anything else right now.
Okay.
No.
Okay, so what we can do now is I'll just read the final statement and then we'll sign the interview. Sorry, give me two moments.
Let's see if there's something.
Interview release form.
I read some of these things off. I wish I'd been able to read somebody else's history so you see exactly. But I had a story here about when I was on a cross-country run, the training run at night in England,
mm-hmm.
and where the oxygen... when you're above 10,000 feet, you have to have your oxygen mask on. And anyway, it came out from the wall. I didn't know it. And we went 10 minutes past. 10 minutes? Yeah, 10 minutes past our turning point. The exercise was you come down this way and that way, and then you come into Bristol, and you're to bomb it, see? And this is a practice run, and then you do as soon as you drop the bombs, theoretically, you make a turn. Well, in this case,
and this was from High Wycombe, sorry.
This we were at Eastmoor.
Okay.
And we had to go around Lyme Regis or whatever,
okay,
and back up, and then go home.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, when you're out at night like that and flying around, it's a little bit difficult for the friends down below to know whether you're an enemy or a foe. So usually they're warned that at a certain time the Halifaxes would be coming over and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we were on that deal and we... I gave the bomb aimer I give him a course to, you know, about 2 minutes ahead of time. This is the course you're going on. You find your target, drop, and then I give a course at the same time. I give a course to the pilot to turn.
Mm-hmm.
Only this time, I passed out the oxygen, you know, wasn't feeding me, my brain.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, we went 10 minutes past this turning point where they were supposed to drop the bomb, mm-hmm. and go. And so immediately, I came to and realized the mistake, so we came back around and got on course again to go to back home or wherever.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but that was a scary thing. I didn't. Well, they all knew because it was all happening under their feet that we hadn't turned at the right time. Mm-hmm. So I came back and then went. Oh, but that was it, this oxygen had pulled out here, and that was my excuse. Oh, terrible.
But nothing like that happened on the actual
operation. No, no. Well, that's why.
Okay.
In training, when these things are supposed to happen. The other thing was that it wouldn't be part of my thing here, but it is something that happened over there. The You can go on a second tour. That is, you complete one tour of 25 or 30 trips, and then you get a little rest. But some of the guys were on second tours, and when they do another 25 or 30. And this was the last trip for a number of guys that were involved like that. And they'd gone over, and they're coming back across, you know, where the wash is, or up, that's where Norfolk. You know, there's a hump there, London's down here, and there's a hump round sort of thing, and then it goes up like that. I don't remember the name of the town. Aircraft was coming back from across the channel and up through that area there. And when you're coming back in over friendly territory, you're to have this, I think they call it IFF, and that is to show that you are a returning friendly aircraft and that you're not to be shot at. They didn't have their IFF on, and they were shot at. And here was all these guys. There's about half of them, I think there was eight in the aircraft, but about half of them were on second tours, last trip on, and they got shot down, lost everybody. And there's a monument over there to them. I've seen a picture of it, but I haven't seen it actually. Right where the crash site was. But that isn't part of my story here, but I know where to look it up in the book, and I'm going to go back down. We have a museum down here, Air Museum in Sydney, at the airport, and there is a book in there of all the casualties of the Second World War, Canadian casualties of the Second World War, Air Force. Yeah. And if you know any of your names, well, you can look them up in the book.
Okay.
And so this Ted Hayes was one of our crew's good friends, especially my pilots. He was a squadron leader. Bill was a squadron leader at that time too, I think. Yeah, okay.
Okay, so this concludes the Military Oral History Program interview with Barry Hall on the 6th of March 2015. Thank you very much for participating in this program, and finally I'd just like to ask you to sign this interview release form. So if you write your name up there.
Write or print?
Print. So just that first line there.
That's good enough for middle name, just
initials, fine, yeah. And then I can fill those bits in. And then if you just sign
interviewee.
There.
Yep.
And then eight.
Six?
Yeah.
I'll put it in the Canadian way.
Yeah.
03. Put out. What are we? Oh, 15.
15, yeah.
Why are they
and
going
then,
on? Okay.
I'll sign at the bottom as well. Okay, we've both signed the interview release form. Is that correct? You could just confirm.
I confirm. Yes.
Thank you very much.
Oh.